Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-3120, United States of America versus Mark Wayne Russell, appellant. Mr. Axum for the appellant, Mr. Smith for the appellee.
Tony Axum representing appellant Mark Russell. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. As the government concedes, Mr. Russell is entitled to remand for resentencing because the district court's special condition that Mr. Russell not use any computer for any purpose for 30 years was overbroad. The court should also remand because the 30-year term of supervised release is greater than necessary to accomplish the statutory goals of sentencing under 18 U.S.C. 1335A. 3553A. No presumption exists in this case that the 30-year term of supervised release is reasonable. Although the guideline range for a sex offense is 3 years to life for supervised release, this is neither a guideline nor a range. It is in effect no different than the statutory maximum for supervised release. Thus, the purported guideline range for supervised release does not advance the goals of providing uniformity, consistency, and eliminating disparities recognized
is there any case in which a court has not accorded the presumption of reasonableness to a guideline range?
I'm not aware of a case where the court has not accorded the presumption of reasonableness to a guideline range.
And your theory is because it's a broad range, there shouldn't be a presumption of reasonableness because virtually any sentence will fall within the range?
Essentially, it's yes.
But in this case, the length of the term of supervised release was not the maximum. The judge imposed less than the maximum.
It was not the maximum, but Mr. Russell was sentenced to 46 months incarceration. It was 8 times longer than the sentence of incarceration, and he's a 50-year-old man. A 30-year term of supervised release is essentially a lifetime supervised release.
Maybe not. It wasn't life.
It wasn't life. Right.
And the sentence was at the bottom of the guideline range, wasn't it?
The
sentence of incarceration.
Yes, was at the bottom of the guideline range.
At sentencing, your client's counsel raised the issue of, I guess it's Bureau of Justice Statistics, indicating that, in fact, offenders of this sort are comparatively unlikely to be recidivists. Are you pursuing that argument?
It was not raised in my brief, but it is correct that the Bureau of Justice statistics show that sex offenders recidivate at a rate lower than the general prison population. And for that reason, It makes less sense based on the individual circumstances of this case, of Mr. Russell's case, that it's true that it's not the highest, but for practical purposes, it is very close to the highest term of supervised release that would be imposed. The average lifespan for a male is below 80 years.
Your argument would be, perhaps it is, I'm not sure, that the sentence was unreasonable, because in light of the general data on recidivism and the defendant's specific characteristics, the likelihood of its being necessary for the 30 years was remote.
That is correct. The 30-year sentence and really the lifetime, the guideline range that places the maximum at lifetime, at lifetime supervised release utterly disregards the parsimony clause of 3553. If a lifetime of supervised release is always authorized and the presumption is applied, and any court that imposes up to the lifetime, if that sentence is presumptively reasonable, there's never really any analysis under the parsimony clause as to whether it was greater than necessary if the presumption is invoked. The presumption stops the analysis there.
But you're still free to try to overcome the presumption by showing that the court failed to consider specific factors that the court should have considered.
That is correct. Right? And in this case, Mr. Russell does overcome the presumption. The court did not consider the guideline. The guidelines themselves don't consider his employment record, his military record, the effect of his conviction on his family.
But aren't those disfavored factors under the guidelines?
Those are disfavored in the guidelines, right. And the guidelines says that a court should not consider them. Those were factors that were present in this case, and there's no indication that the court considered them.
Well, I thought you just said that you agreed with me that they're disfavored.
They are disfavored under the guidelines.
Right.
So they would only.
So how could we overcome?
They are not disfavored.
If there was some exceptional
reason
for them to be important here, right?
Well, the guidelines say that they ordinarily should not be considered. And 3553, there's a conflict between the guidelines and 3553 because 3553 does not place that same limitation on consideration of somebody's background. In fact, background and history, everything in the background and history should be considered. So for the guideline to take something out, if we are going to, once again, presume that the guidelines capture what 3553 once captured, in this case, we have factors that 3553 says should be considered, and the guidelines say, no, we do not want you to consider it. So there's a conflict, and where that conflict arises, Rita and Gall have said courts should follow 3553, not the guidelines. The whole reason that the Supreme Court has allowed this presumption to exist is precisely because there's a belief that the guidelines approximate sentences that capture all 3553 information.
But don't we also have a statute here, right? 3583K.
3583K.
Makes the term 5 years to life.
3553, 83K, it simply sets the statutory maximum. It doesn't
correct
control the guidelines. Every criminal statute has a statutory maximum.
Right.
So the fact that the statutory maximum was changed for supervised release doesn't automatically make doesn't necessarily mean that statutory maximum incorporates all of the 3553 factors. There still has to be an analysis done under 3553. And in this case, there is an absence of that analysis. There are factors that should have been considered that were not considered. The government...
You mean the court didn't consider them? Which ones did the court not consider? You said the excellent military record, for example?
Yes.
Well, the court did consider it, right?
I would say that...
He didn't take it into... He considered it and rejected it as a relevant factor. Didn't he? In fact, he thought it worked against the defendant.
The court did... consider the court certainly considered many of the factors that were raised by defense counsel. If we're talking about
I'm just talking about the ones you raise here. I'm only talking about the ones you raise here.
Yes.
And that's one of the ones you raise here, and the district court did consider it.
The district court did consider it. Yeah. We can only assume that the district court rejected everything that the defense raised.
Well, no, he gave a reason for this one. He said, in fact, he said, not only do I reject it, I think it works against him. Didn't he?
I don't recall.
He did. He said, I think he did. I think he said, quote, he goes against him because he had those opportunities. He said we might be talking about a different situation if he had been abused. Now, whether we agree with that analysis or not, the fact is the district court did consider it.
Very well.
Right?
I can't deny that the district court considered it. The district court considered it and rejected it. The question now is, what did the court base its sentence on? It can certainly reject. The court certainly has the discretion to reject everything that the defense says. But the district court still did not provide reasons for why 30 years of supervised release, certainly under the parsimony clause, was not greater than necessary to achieve the statutory goals of sentencing. The court did say that it was concerned about protecting the public, but only in the most general sense. It didn't relate that in any individual or specific way to Mr. Russell's, the nature and circumstances of his offense and the history and background in his case. And sentencing is really individualized. That is what Rita and Gall recommend that sentencing courts, the process that sentencing courts engage in is to individualized sentencing. The need to protect the public exists in every single case. If that is the basis for a sentence, the parsimony clause loses all effect because the need to protect the public should only, I guess, drive the sentence to the extent that the sentence is still no greater than necessary to protect the public. The court did not point to any factor that suggested that the public needed to be protected in this case any greater than any other case. In the absence of some factor, either in the record or that the court cited, the sentence in this case was essentially imposed because Mr. Russell was convicted of a sex offense. There was no individualization, and
can I ask you a question about the computer use? It seems that both of you agree that it was overbroad, and this particular judge told us in no uncertain terms, or told you all in no uncertain terms, that he was going to do what the Court of Appeals told him to do. In other words, I think we need to give him some guidance if it does go back on what is wrong with this ban on computer use. What is your position? That I read from the sentencing, and you weren't the lawyer, I know, but is it your position that he should be allowed computer use at his job, that he should not have access to a computer at home or personally, or what are you going to tell the district judge as far as what is a reasonable restriction on the computer use?
The probation office has available to it many different ways to monitor computer use.
Well, I'm asking, what is your position on what would be a reasonable restriction on computer use?
A reasonable restriction would be for the probation office to employ one of the systems that it uses to see the websites that Mr. Russell has seen. There are other cases where the probation office has required a defendant to record each website and provide a daily log of each website.
All right. Now, are you talking about a personal computer or at work? Because part of your argument is that this restricts his livelihood. So what is it that you would want the probation office to do with respect to any computer use at work? Nothing?
The question is difficult to answer because it's very easy to say
that. Well, you're going to have to, I mean, if it goes back, the district judge is going to have to come up with something less than a lifetime ban on computer use.
If the probation office could also monitor each website he visits at work. I'm not sure that I see a reason for there to be a difference in how they monitor the websites, home versus work. What comes to mind is that most employers monitor computer use at work. So if the employer has a system in place and it is left to the probation office to determine how to record the websites that Mr. Russell views at work, they can coordinate with his employer.
Okay.
I believe there has to be some flexibility for the probation office to monitor it.
All right. You're over your time. We'll give you a couple minutes. Mr. Smith?
May it please the court, Peter Smith on behalf of the United States.
Can I ask you just what is your position on what would, since you agree that this is overbroad?
Now, with respect to your last question for appellant, Judge Henderson, upon remand, the government suggests that the first thing that the district court ought to do, is to further define what it means by computer, and one of the issues would be that appellant would be allowed to use, for example, a GPS in a car or an ATM, but not a computer that has internet access or the ability to communicate with other computers. The second portion of a remand order we suggest would continue the computer ban, but the ban would be subject to revision by the probation office. And the cases that are cited in the government's brief have upheld bans so long as they are subject to revision by the probation office.
Total bans?
A total ban, that's correct. And of course,
that's that one case that was just for 3 years, though, wasn't it?
Well, that was the one case, I think it's called Hughes in the Fifth Circuit, where there was a ban and it was not subject to revision by the probation office, and that was for the entire 3-year term of appellant, the defendant in that case's supervised release. And we distinguish that by saying the other cases allow revision by the probation office. But
is there any public record of what the probation office does in these matters?
There is.
I mean, it seems to me that it is being banned from access to an ordinary computer as opposed to a GPS. Means he's banned from most livelihoods.
That could be if the livelihood requires the use of a computer. The cases that are cited in the government's brief that talk about revision subject to the probation office, and I'm not recalling the name right now, but the court would have to look at those cases. I'm thinking that one of them is called White, but there's an extended discussion, and the case is a number of years old, but there's an extended discussion about the means by which a probation office could employ to monitor computer use in that case. But again, Judge Walton, and the government agrees with Judge Walton on this front, appellant is very tech savvy. His background, according to appellant's brief, is in computers, and it's not clear that his ability to use computers argues for use. It can argue against it and support Judge Walton's ban because he would be able to circumvent that kind of monitoring. So we would urge the court to leave those kinds of considerations to the probation office or to the district court and simply remand saying that there would be a ban subject to revision by the probation office. And if appellant can work with his probation officer either he identifies a job where he needs a computer or he identifies some method by which he could be monitored, then that would be something that the probation office could handle. If I could now turn to the court's earlier colloquy with Mr. Axum about the merits. Here, the court did not err, let alone plainly err, in opposing the term of supervised release. As Judge Tatel suggested earlier, the court actually did consider each of the factors it's required to under 3553. And in fact, in the first sentencing hearing, and this is in the transcript of the first sentencing hearing at page 21, the court specifically addressed appellant's military history and, as Judge Tatel suggested, argued that worked against appellant, stating you would think somebody who is at the rank he is in the military with the history he's had, as soon as he thought this was a child, that he would have shut this down, meaning that his military training and his leadership abilities would have caused him not to commit the offense that he committed.
What do you think of his argument that the presumption of reasonableness just doesn't make any sense when you have a range this broad, because that means any sentence will enjoy a presumption of reasonableness?
Well, I don't. First of all, Congress has specifically provided both in statute for that term, and so has the Sentencing Commission. The court has got to look at the policy statements and the guidelines and consider them in applying a term of supervised release. And the guidelines themselves say that the court should impose life. So actually, what the court did was do less than even the guidelines.
Yeah, but I was asking a different question. They're saying normally the presumption of reasonableness works because, you know, the district judge's discretion is circumscribed somewhat. And Rita says that where the sentence is within that range, it enjoys a presumption of reasonableness. If it's outside the range, it doesn't. Here, there is no outside.
Well, that's
their point.
Well, the judge is correct that Your Honor is correct that the range is very broad, but I'm not aware of any case that says
it's unlimited. You couldn't have a. There'd be no way. You would not have a sentence that was outside this range unless it was under 5 years.
But then
who would we wouldn't have the case, I guess, unless the government brought it up. That's true.
Well,
but there's no way a defendant would be able to challenge it. All sentences would be presumed reasonable. From the defendant's point of view.
From the defendant's perspective, unless the sentence were under, in which case he wouldn't contest it.
Right, that was my point.
Right. My response is that I'm unaware of any case that says that the fact that it's a broad range.
Yeah, me too, but is there
any case been presented with the
issue? Yeah, exactly.
Of a range so broad that Rita right. doesn't apply. I'm not aware of any such case. And I would know.
There's very few. How many? There's this crime and you have there's an equally broad supervised release term for some kinds of murder, right? But anything else?
I'm not aware of anything else.
And so it's not unlikely that this would not have come up. I mean, this may be the first case.
It may be, but I would suggest that Congress knew what it was doing in statute authorizing a life term of supervised release for specific sex-based offenses like the one appellant committed, and the guidelines writers.
Well, what is that? There's still a question of the judge's exercise of discretion and whether there's a bonus or a presumption for fitting within the guidelines. It seems odd because it's almost impossible for him to get out from inside the guidelines.
I think that's because the guidelines
and the statute.
And the guidelines work in conjunction with the statute, and the guidelines are supposed to carry out the statutory purposes, as we explained in our brief. And I think that that's ultimately what Rita is about. And that's why I think that the court need not be concerned in this unique case of sexual-based offenses where Congress has recognized that the particular conduct at issue it requires or is worthy of a life term, up to a life term of supervised release. And I understand the court's question about a broad length of term, but I think when one considers the specific conduct appellant committed in conjunction with Congress's rationale for providing for a life term of supervised release, that you would not get outside of RITA where you have Congress specifically addressing this issue. I would agree that the district court certainly needs to exercise its discretion appropriately, but Congress has specifically authorized and made findings that in these particular cases that this is appropriate, and so have the guideline writers. So I would find it hard to say from the opposite perspective that that the district court's use of discretion to carry out Congress's wishes would be unreasonable under RITA, and I'm not aware of any such case.
What of the risk of recidivism, which seems to have driven the judge's thinking?
I think it did in part.
Contrast with the data produced by the Department of Justice on the subject.
Actually, when the court mentioned that earlier, I was unaware of that portion.
It's mentioned in the sentencing transcript.
Accurately,
so far as I could make out.
I was not aware of that, but
It shows recidivism for this type of crime way, way below, for example, drug recidivism.
Well, Judge Walton was applying his particular experience with...
Does that make any sense at all? We're talking about probabilities, and he's not a social scientist. The social scientists in your department who work on these things and come up with results which appear to be quite meaningful, and a sentence is imposed in complete disregard on a premise which is in complete disregard of the Department of Justice's findings.
Well, I don't think it's merely a question of percentages. The court certainly can...
Well, the judge didn't think that this guy was some kind of special child sex offender. It was the class of child sex offenders that he saw before him, and he said sort of total recidivism, right? But that the data are just completely different.
Well, that was Judge Walton's experience, and also based upon hearings that he'd had and evidence in other cases, and the court is certainly entitled to consider his or her own experience in determining an appropriate sentence and a reasonable sentence. Specifically, Judge Walton was considering appellant's conduct. Now, appellant's conduct fell within the class of sexual-based offenses, but Judge Walton was doing the same thing that appellant himself, when given the opportunity to address the district court, did, which was to say, offenders like me, if the court looks at the first sentencing transcript at page 25, appellant himself is addressing the district court and says, the court shouldn't concern itself with what offenders like me, and I'm paraphrasing, think. And appellant himself is classing himself as a sexual offender. And
the question is the thought of one district judge based on presumably a very limited data set, does that completely trump an elaborate survey conducted by the Department of Justice?
Well, I don't think the court, even if Judge Walton were asked to address that question, which he wasn't in this particular hearing, he would say that his experience perhaps doesn't necessarily trump it, and he's also considering many of the other factors, which we could list one at a time.
Yeah, but recidivism seemed to drive the whole thing.
I think public safety, and perhaps the court is viewing that as recidivism, but I think public safety is more than simply recidivism,
if you had a guarantee that the person would not do it again, that would take care of the public safety, except so far as the issue was of deterring others.
What one would think, but the court also expressly considered a number of other factors. It considered the need for treatment, which is one of the factors it is supposed to consider. It also considered the nature of appellant's offense,
that's the category.
Right, and certainly considered that, certainly considered the need for training, certainly considered public safety and deterrence and the need for uniformity in sentence, expressly considered each of those things. So I think the court's focus on recidivism the court should also take into account the fact that the court considered all of the factors and doesn't have to consider each of them expressly, but did reference the factors as a whole and then went through a number of them. If there are no other questions, I would urge the court to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Axon, why don't you take a minute?
I'd like to address very briefly the government's expressions that Mr. Russell's livelihood, that his computer use should be limited based on the livelihood that he chooses. Mr. Russell has been released and has already, almost every job application that he has to fill out has to be by computer now. Even at a McDonald's, he has applied at Petco, and they use a computer to take the animals in and take the animals out. He received framing skills while in prison. He applied at AC Moore to do framing, and they use a computer to frame the pictures. It is likely that most places use a computer now. So to suggest that there could be a job or that there are jobs available that don't is hard to understand. The government also said that Congress and the court both knew what they were doing when they enacted 3583K. Well, originally, the maximum term of supervised release for a sex offense was 5 years, and that was set by the supervised release statute. And the guidelines said that for sex offenses, they had a policy statement that is still the same policy statement that the government is invoking right now before 3583K was enacted. And that policy statement was that for a sex offense, the maximum term of supervised release authorized by law shall be the guideline range. Now, after the PROTECT Act and 3583K was passed, the maximum term changed from 5 years to life. The guidelines did not revise their policy statement or revisit that. So to suggest that the guidelines and Congress acted in lockstep in coming up with this very broad guideline range is simply incorrect.
All right, we have your argument. Thank you.
Thank you.
Call the next case.